This week in Chicago history now with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, you know what Thanksgiving means to me. 16-inch softball history.
We got to do it, Bob. We do it every year. But this, it is such a great anniversary when you think about how 16-inch softball was founded in Chicago. And the cool history, November 1887, way back then, Thanksgiving Day, Harvard-Yale alums, you know this so well. They were gathered at the Farragut Boat Club, which is kind of west side, near west side, where we're now, of course, long gone. But they were hanging out, killing time, while they were waiting the score of the Ivy League football game being played on the East Coast, by the way. So it took some time there. This was pre-ESPN, Bob, you know, pre-internet, and pre-Dave Ennett and WGN. You couldn't just get the scores. You had to wait for them. Mm-hmm. And so they were waiting for the Telegraph to get the sports scores to them. And it took a while. So somebody picked up the boxing glove, wrapped it up in a ball, somebody picked up a broomstick, and voila, 16-inch softball, or softball, was born. Fast forward, though, the Chicago invention, you know, it's interesting to think about it, because the 16-inch version, as I know what you played, and became so popular across the city for generations. Legendary columnist Mike Royko, one of the most famous players, other than Bob Surratt and Michael Jordan, of course, but he, you know, when he got the Hall of Fame trophy, his family says it was more important than the Pulitzer Prize. Such a cool thing. We pulled a clip of Royko's story on his thoughts. A very rare TV interview, actually. He talks about softball, among other things.
I don't see anything wrong with playing softball. I'm not yet 50, although I'm approaching it, I suppose.
We all are.
But softball is not as strenuous as, say, tennis, racquetball. Guys play these games until they're a lot older than I am, so why not play softball? I enjoy it. It's fun. I could probably put a team together of guys over 40 years old that would beat 95% of the teams in Chicago. Age really isn't a factor in softball because it's slow pitch. What you need is cunning, patience,
and general lack of intelligence.
And you, as Satchel Paige said, you know, avoid running at all.
As I've said before, Royko wouldn't talk to me until I was on the softball field with him for some sort of media charity game. And after that, he spoke to me. After that, I was okay.
Then you were, like, highly regarded.
Yeah.
You were held there's a great video, too, Bob, of him smoking cigarettes while playing softball.
Sure.
Like, while he's rounding the bases, of course.
Yeah.
Right.
This is an interesting story about Chicago's oldest retailer. Tell us about C.D. Peacock's.
Yeah, okay, so before Montgomery Ward's, before Sears, before all of them, C.D. Peacock was actually the oldest, first long-serving retailer in the Chicago area. It made a major move this week that would have an impact on the city for years to come, Bob. It was known as House of Peacock back then, established in 1837, a year before Chicago even became a city. And this week, over a century ago, they decided to open a grand jewelry store inside the Palmer House Hotel. And the debut was a huge story in town, much talked about, this adding further luster to this elegant hotel and the grand entrance that they created. C.D. Peacock spent a princely sum to build two elaborate brass doors with peacocks engraved on them. And it was this, you know, they're still there to this day. I mean, you'll see the beautiful brass doors crafted by Louis Tiffany himself, of Tiffany's fame. So it became an iconic part of the Palmer House over the years because C.D. Peacock actually left. And their Architectural Digest listed them as one of the top 25 doors in the world, just in terms of, you know, their beauty and history, and kind of a cool thing. Still there to this day. Also, fun fact, C.D. Peacock, they had a main vault in their main store that survived the Chicago fire. Its contents, the fine jewelry, totally fine, made it through the fire, one of the few structures in the downtown area to do that.
Cool. This week in 1927, C.D. Peacock's opens in the Palmer House. Another fun fact, strange but true, I worked with Bob Peacock, was his name, part of that Peacock family, and we worked together as pages, guides at NBC. So you have Peacock working at NBC. How about that? Yeah. Amazing.
That is so cool.
Let's talk about the end of Harpo Studios back in 2016.
2016, The Wrecking Ball and the Bulldozers wiped out the last signs of Harpo Studios in the West Loop, Bob, making way for the multi-story $600 million McDonald's headquarters for 2,000 employees to move into. And ultimately, it really triggered part of the transformation of that neighborhood. The Google building did that. There's some other major moments in that neighborhood that just signaled the total transformation. And this was one of them. Oprah was a pioneer. She often talked about the rats she'd have to step over on her way to work and the characters she'd meet outside. You know, it was really an industrial kind of meatpacking area when she moved in, and a little bit abandoned in that particular area, not much going on. But the location, 1058 West Washington, has great history in the city. It was a cold storage building for the meatpackers in one day. It was a temporary morgue for some time. It was it was a skating rink as well. And then, of course, it turned into one of the most famous couch jumping locations when Tom Cruise jumped on the couch and the place where a rising political star, Barack Obama, made his came there shortly after announcing he was running for president, and one of the most famous car giveaways in the history of car giveaways. But Oprah said back then, and it was all happening and coming to her, she said it wasn't really setting in back in 2016. She wasn't really able to kind of process what this was all about, what was happening.
You know, I used to come in every morning and I would think, wow, I own this building. Gee, this is where I work and I am responsible for everything that goes on in this building. Kind of hard to wrap my brain around all of that. Yeah, because, you know, when you're anybody who is working at and doing what you love, you're just working at doing what you love. You're not thinking about it in terms of, wow, this makes me very powerful or this makes me very influential. You're just working at doing what you love. And so when I sit here, yeah, I don't often think about everything that's gone on here. I just think about whatever is going on in this particular moment. And there will come a time when I will let it all go, and I will probably think about everything that actually happened here.
That really was the beginning of the revitalization of the West Loop, wasn't it? When she opened up there, when she first opened.
Right. Right. And then the things that happened after that, you know, now you look at it, you don't even recognize what it once was. But it's interesting history.
All I want for Christmas is Mickey's Silly Land.
Yeah, Mickey and Minnie and the Mag Mile Lights Fest. It's back again. And Anna, I never realized this tradition goes way back, doesn't it?
Way back to 1949. Are you ready for the holiday season, Bob? Are you ready?
I'm never ready for it. And Thanksgiving is late this year, so we're going to get Thanksgiving next week, and then all of a sudden it's going to be Christmas.
It is so true. Well, it's, you know, that's one sure sign that the holiday season is upon us, is the Mag Mile Lights Festival. That's this Saturday. It's coming up. A million lights illuminating the Mag Mile. Just a really magical tradition in Chicago. We used to be right outside our studios, and remember outside the Tribune Tower, we'd all gather as a, you know, station. We'd watch it, and it's so cool. This tradition dates back to 1949, when the Greater North Michigan Avenue Retail Organization got together, decided to do something to kick off the holiday shopping season and encourage people to shop downtown. So they started out with a tree lighting ceremony, and that was done outside Water Tower Place with a big celebration, and a lot of people gathered, and it was a cool celebration. But then Saks Fifth Avenue jumped in a couple of years later. They created a huge lights display outside their store. Soon other Michigan Avenue stores did their own thing with elaborate lights displays. And then the Michigan Avenue organization said, let's get together on this. Let's do something and make it, you know, centralized. So they did. And then fast forward to 1992, and Disney got involved. Mickey and Minnie and Goofy and Donald and Disney stars that come out, and Santa and the reindeer and the whole thing. The marching bands I love, too. You have a lot of local marching bands that come out and just really set the energy for the whole event. So grab your warm coat, Bob. Get Marianne and get out there this Saturday, 5:30. The parade kicks off, but they do the tree lighting earlier, or ceremony a little bit before.
Fireworks bedtime at 7:30. Bedtime, yeah, bedtime, right after the fireworks start. Two anniversaries for the legendary Orion Samuelson this week, huh?
Yeah. This marks a few major moments in WGN history and the history of legendary broadcaster Orion Samuelson, one of the most loved and respected broadcasters ever to grace the airwaves, if I might add, major career moment, and the moment he decided to hang up the microphone after a storied 60-year career. Orion made that announcement of his retirement 60 years to the month back September 2020. So around the holidays, around this time, he started to back off from his day-to-day responsibilities, and we didn't see him in the building as much. And after 4 years, he called it a career. But there's also another major anniversary. This week, 1963, marks 57 years since Orion ripped the copy off the wires as a young broadcaster then and informed a large portion of the Midwest, a huge swath of America, that President Kennedy had been assassinated. If you think about that, he'd only been at GN for 3 years, and it was on his watch when this happened. So pretty incredible moment for him, and rose to the occasion and delivered the news with the calm and the dignity that has come to, you know, classify his entire career. So it's just interesting that that moment happened, and that Orion was really the agriculture reporter at the time. But he was assigned, that was the moment when it happened, and he was there, and he handled it with all of the dignity and respect. He handles everything. We pulled a cool clip here. I think your listeners will enjoy Bob Orion Samuelson on the Friday Night Show with Bob Surratt back in 2003. The Big O, already a legend.
What was it that Bob Collins used to call it?
Hogs and frogs.
Hogs and frogs.
I always introduce the Hogs and Frogs report. But what you just said is something I've heard from many, many people. Don't really understand everything you're saying or what you're talking about, but do enjoy listening. And over the years, I think we've helped people understand a little bit about what it takes to put food on the table.
Yeah, and you always sort of rocked and rolled with great humor, great good humor, with Bob Collins, to name one. You two got pretty close, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. And it's interesting because when Bob arrived at WGN, I go back to Eddie Hubbard and Wally Phillips and Carl Grayson and all of those people. And then Bob arrived on the scene. Totally different from any personality on WGN. A little wild and outland. I really didn't like him. And it took about 6 months before I started to warm up. And when we lost him, we were the closest of friends, really. We were going to, as Bob said, someday we're going to sit on the front stoop in the rocking chairs and watch the desert go by in Arizona. I miss him.
That was one of my favorite Chicago Tonight WTTW interviews. Well, what a great voice. Always good to hear from the Big O.
Absolutely. And we got to learn what pork bellies were as kids, too, from the Big O.
Anna DeLantis, thanks. Talk to you next week.
Good morning.